Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Lynn Nesner, attorney number 39209. I'm here on behalf of the appellate defendant, Mr. Davis. Before I begin, I would like to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal. I will be focusing on the first issue that has to do with Mr. Davis's right to represent himself. In this case, Mr. Davis wanted to be the master of his own destiny and have personal control over his defense. As he told the court, "If I lose, I'd rather lose because of myself." The district court deprived him of his autonomy and this important constitutionally protected choice based on assumptions about his psychiatric issues. However, Mr. Davis was never found to be incompetent, nor was there evidence that he suffered from severe mental illness. Thus, there was not support for the district court's findings. In Ferretta v. California, the United States Supreme Court held that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel includes the right to forego counsel and choose self-representation. The Supreme Court recognized that it is the defendant, not the state or counsel, who will bear the consequences of a conviction. Before a defendant may go pro se, the defendant must meet two requirements. First, the defendant must be competent to make the decision, and the defendant must effect a valid waiver, i.e. the waiver must be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. In Godinez, the U.S. Supreme Court held that the level of competency necessary to waive counsel is the same as that necessary to stand trial. That is, the defendant must have the ability or capacity to understand the proceedings. The decision to waive counsel does not require a higher level of competency or functioning than the decision to waive any other constitutional right.
Well, Ms. Nesner, I appreciate what I don't know if it's pronounced Godinez or Godinez, and I apologize. I don't know, but we've got Indiana versus Edwards to deal with here. And so Indiana versus Edwards indicates that in certain circumstances, a court can look at a defendant who is competent, would be competent to plead, for example, because that's what Godinez talks about, but can say, look, you've got some mental illness problems here that I think make you, for want of a better term, this is my phrase, incompetent to stand trial, so I'm going to force counsel on you. So let's address that. Why can't the court do that?
Edwards does create an exception for severely mentally ill defendants. And under those circumstances, which are not the circumstances that are present here, a state may insist upon counsel.
But what's the difference here?
Here the difference is that there was no evidence of mental illness.
Wasn't there some evidence of paranoia, post-traumatic stress disorder, hyperactivity disorder, and those sorts of things? Wasn't that in the record?
There was evidence that Mr. Davis reported he suffered from bipolarism and paranoia, as he told the court during both Arguello advisements, that he was taking Wellbutrin to control the symptoms of those. And there was also in the competency evaluations, the most thorough competency report is the third one prepared by Dr. Fukutaki, and she reviewed some of his medical records, and there was a note that he suffered from depression and that he had reported to jail medical personnel that he had been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and ADHD. But she did not adopt any of the findings in those medical records.
Isn't the trial court entitled to rely on what the defendant tells him about his mental status? I mean, if the guy says, which he apparently did, that, hey, I'm bipolar. Now, I'm taking medication, but I'm bipolar. And I'm paranoid, taking medication, but I'm paranoid. Can't the court rely on that?
Before you answer, counsel, let me fix something. We have a little problem with the clock.
I'm sorry, I haven't
said
it.
Go ahead. And then we'll just hold on a second. We'll count it down.
Okay.
That's quite all right. Bailiff is starting to decompensate. We're fine. Okay, now go ahead and answer the question, counsel.
I'm sorry.
I think the trial court can rely on what he reports, but he reported that he was taking medicine to control his symptoms and that his medicine helped him.
But then we have his behavior.
His behavior, yes, during 2006, his behavior was that he did not speak to his counsel at the time, and he refused to speak to the competency evaluators. But prior to, or at the same time that the court ordered the first competency evaluation, the court advised him that he had the right to refuse to participate in evaluation. So, he had a statutory as well as constitutional right to remain silent. I think the trial court placed far too much emphasis on his choice to be silent or not to participate in those evaluations as being indicative of mental illness. And I mean, even the second evaluator, Dr. McIntyre, said that his choice could be symptomatic of mental illness, yes, but it could also be symptomatic of his rational decision. And so for the court to use that,
What about his threat to his first lawyer?
I mean, it's clear he didn't like that lawyer. They had issues, and that lawyer was removed. But the lawyer that was replaced, Mr. Pink, Ms. Murden, she said she didn't have any of the problems that he had. And it was her opinion that he was competent to make that decision to forego counsel. And she didn't really, she agreed with Dr. Fukutaki's opinion that he was competent.
Well, did she agree with that, or did she say something to the effect of,
she thought it was ill-advised.
Very ill-advised for a defendant to proceed pro se, but that's all I really have to add. Isn't that what she said?
She said at the beginning of, so he made, I mean, in the beginning of 2007, he made several requests to go pro se. I mean, sort of continuously throughout 2007, he was requesting to go pro se and very adamant about that. And the court advised him on January 16th and March 7th. And I believe at the beginning of January 16th, she said that he was, I can find it in the record. She said, I have concerns as to his ability to effectively represent himself in a pro se capacity, but as to making the decision on how he wants to proceed, I think he's competent. And really, the trial court's denial of his request was based on the trial court's finding that he lacked competency to make a waiver. And you referenced, Judge Menard, his behavior in 2006, which is what the trial court largely relies on. But I think part of the problem with the trial court's findings is that the trial court didn't consider his behavior in 2007. And one of the points that the U.S. Supreme Court makes in Edwards is that mental illness is not a unitary concept. It changes in time. It varies in degrees. And in 2007, he was showing a lot of rational conduct. During both Arguello advisements, he was coherent and articulate. He was properly oriented as to time, place, person. He didn't exhibit any disorganized or confused speech. He offered reasonable grounds for why he wanted to proceed per se. And he, you know, requested advisory counsel, showing that he understood sort of the dangers of being pro se. And after the March 7th advisement, the court even noted, prior to looking at his competency reports, that he seemed articulate and that there was no question he understood what they're talking about.
A lot of time so far talking about the circumstances. I understand the center of your argument really is that the court applied the wrong standard, that it in derogation of Godinez, it simply seemed to suggest that there's one standard for standing trial and a different standard.
I would say Yes, it's that the court held him to a higher standard legally, and that factually there was not support. There was not support for him being severely mentally ill.
Court observed that he was competent to stand trial. There was no question about that. So under the Godinez case,
he would be.
He's competent to waive.
Yes.
And the question then is whether he executed a valid waiver. And then what do we do with this now new standard, this Edwards piece that comes in? And I'm wondering why, I guess I want to run this by you. Does it make sense that we would be arguing the significance of the Edwards case for the first time on appeal? In light of the facts that were available to the trial court, whether the trial court would have said, I think that you are one of these exceptional defendants in the gray area here, that although competent to stand trial, isn't competent to go stand trial alone.
I think this court can decide this issue based on the record before applying de novo review, looking at his waivers that he made on January 16th and March 7th. And find that he did waive his right to counsel, and therefore, by being forced to go to trial, he was deprived of his Sixth Amendment rights. I think that.
But as to Edwards, you think we can decide in the first instance, and you would argue that what we would conclude then under the Edwards standard is that he was not one of these defendants who could be forced to take counsel.
Yes, I would say that Edwards is the exception for the severely mentally ill. I mean, if you look at Mr. Edwards, he was found incompetent twice. It took nearly 6 years for him to be restored to competency and taken to trial. And he had a diagnosed mental illness of paranoid schizophrenia that caused him trouble with thinking. Mr. Davis has nothing similar to that. I mean, he, to the extent that he may have some degree of depression or bipolarism, there's no evidence that his mental defects were so severe as to render him unable to make decisions or conduct a defense. I mean, the Edwards, for people that are severely mentally ill, the Edwards case sort of gives the district court a little discretion or allows state to say that for these people, we should be looking at whether they could conduct a defense at trial and whether they would be deprived of a fair trial because they are so mentally ill. Here, Mr. Davis was filing pro se motions. I mean, he was arguing points of law, and he was addressing the court when he wanted to. He's including legal authority. There's nothing about his conduct in 2007 that would suggest he has a severe mental illness, such as paranoid schizophrenia, that prevents him from being able to conduct his own defense at trial. You know, he might not conduct as well as a defense as a lawyer, but as any other layperson, he stood just a chance. I mean, there was no indication that his mental illness was interfering with his cognitive abilities. In fact, I mean, Dr. Fukutaki found that there was no evidence to support any kind of significant cognitive impairment or mental illness.
Pardon me. Go ahead. Pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Nessner. I'm sorry. Is the issue here whether the court abused its discretion in making those findings? I mean, that seems to be the argument that you're making, is that there's basically no factual support for that. I mean, is this an abuse of discretion analysis?
No. I mean, it's a mixed question of law and fact. And so I would say it's legally, you guys have to decide what standard applies and whether he was competent under that standard and whether the court correctly applied the standard, which I'm arguing that no, at the time, competent to stand trial is competent to make the decision. And to the extent that Edwards now applies because his case is on appeal, he still is not he still does not fit the category of defendants envisioned in Edwards, so that standard should not apply. To the extent that the court made sort of factual findings based on references in the competency reports, like records that the court didn't review and weren't adopted by the competency evaluators, that those findings are clearly erroneous and don't deserve deference.
Ask you a question before your time runs out, Ms. Nessner. If Godina says that if defendant is competent to proceed to trial, defendant is competent to waive right to counsel, mm-hmm. right? And then we have Edwards come along, and Edwards says that there's a different standard for those who are suffering from severe mental illness to the point where they're not competent to conduct trial proceedings by themselves. Mm-hmm. Is there a problem with applying that standard to this case because we're talking about waiver of right to counsel rather than the ability to conduct trial proceedings? Do we have another separation there in a level of competency?
I think to the extent that Edwards is an interesting case because it does not overrule Ferretta or Godinez, but it is suggesting that the court should go into a defendant's ability to function at trial, which is part of Ferretta says, no, that's not part of the determination at all. But a division of this court in Wilson and also the 10th Circuit have said that Godinez is still the proper standard. And so I think Edwards is just a very exceptionary rule for severely mentally ill defendants. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Matthew Holman, and I represent the people in this matter. I've now heard several ways to pronounce what I thought was Godinez. I'm tempted to call the case Moran. Otherwise, I think the majority of the court pronounces it Godinez, and maybe I go with the majority. But in any event, I'm going to say Godinez, really. I think the discussion here really shows that there are several facets to this question about the issue of self-representation and mental disorders and competence to stand trial. I sort of divided into two categories. One is what I would call the Arguello-Godinez question, which is about knowing an intelligent and voluntary waiver of counsel. And I think that's what Judge Hoffman addressed in his order. Again, Edwards hadn't come out, and so he didn't have the benefit of that case. And I think what Godinez says, and Arguello in a way indirectly says, is that there are two separate questions. One is the defendant competent to stand trial? And then what Justice Thomas and Godinez called the heightened standard is, but the second question is, can he knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waive his right to counsel? And those are distinct questions. I think the Edwards presents this other facet of the question, which is, can a state recognize that even if a defendant is competent to stand trial, that he may not be competent to represent himself? And I think Judge Hawthorne, that was perhaps the point you were making, is that those may be different questions about whether he can knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently waive the right to counsel. Maybe in some circumstances, a separate question from whether he's also competent to represent himself. And I think in some ways, factually, these things overlap. And I think Justice Breyer maybe sort of in an indirect way talks about how all the cases sort of surround the question that ends up being the question in Edwards. And so there's a certain amount of overlap between those things. Where I would like to sort of focus though is on Judge Hoffman's ruling, which again is that the defendant did not make a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver of his right to counsel, and I would say that's under the Arguello-Godinez sort of approach. And I think the record supports that finding, as Judge Bernard was pointing out. There was evidence that the defendant suffered some forms of mental disorders. He himself said that he was bipolar, suffered a bipolar disorder, that he suffered depression and paranoia. And then one of the doctors, you know, said that, opined that perhaps he also suffered from paranoid schizophrenia, but there seems to be some indecision, I think, driven in part by the defendant's refusal to speak to the psychiatrist or psychologist who are evaluating him. When the defendant spoke to the court and said that he suffered paranoia, he said that although he was taking medicine, it was not completely controlling that paranoia. And I know that Dr. Fukutaki in her report said that that there was an indication the defendant had actually stopped taking his medication for quite some time. So it appears that his mental disorders were not necessarily under control or actually being properly treated. The defendant's behavior also demonstrated that he was suffering from some mental disorders. His own counsel described him as slack-jawed, flat, distant, and unresponsive in their meetings. And the court also saw this during trial court proceedings. At times, he was non-communicative with his counsel, with the evaluating doctors, and with the trial court. And Judge Hoffman points that out in his ruling. He says, given this defendant's lack of communication, I don't remember the exact words, it's hard to imagine that he would knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently decide that he's going to represent himself and do his own defense, given those circumstances. And I think Arguello mentions this, that when the court's aware the defendant has mental problems, the court should consider how his mental condition might affect his understanding of the consequences of the waiver of counsel. And again, I think this sort of dovetails him back into the Edwards sort of concept, albeit in the context of this proper waiver.
I correct that Hoffman's rule, at least in part, is the assumption that there are these two,
one to waive counsel and one to stand trial.
Yes, he does recognize that. He uses a very nice phrase, which I won't be able to repeat, about that this defendant, it operates in the difference between those things, the competency to stand trial and the ability to be capable of waiving the right to counsel. I think, is that, am I?
I guess my impression had been that this idea is already flawed, because of course Godinez tells that it is exactly the same standard. Competence to stand trial is the same competence required to waive counsel.
I think that is what
capacity. Yes, right. The capacity is the same.
I think that's great, but I don't want to interrupt.
Okay. So my next question then, if that's the case, then are you saying that the additional information or the additional capacity? I guess what more is required to execute the knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver? Certainly, I appreciate that there's some additional cognition. That capacity doesn't answer the question about volition and cognition, about what's in your head and whether you really want to do this. But are you suggesting that although you have the capacity to waive counsel, that there may be some additional competencies in terms of, can you understand, can you really achieve the level of knowingness or intelligence necessary? So that in effect, there is a heightened competency or capacity standard. Is that what's going on?
I think that's the way I understand how those pieces fit together. Again, in Godinez, where Justice Thomas mentions that there's this additional determination about knowing, voluntary, intelligent, indicating that even if you're competent to stand trial, and that alone may give you the competency, whether you in fact have the capacity to then knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently is still a question for the trial court to decide. And obviously that can be informed by your mental health issues.
I appreciated that. I understood that slightly differently. So I appreciate your answer here, because I thought the inquiry was, okay, now that you have it, since it is the same capacity, do you in fact understand? And if you don't, what else can we tell you? What more do you need to know? But that there isn't, because it would be strange to me that if we say, okay, it's the same capacity, but not really, because you have to understand some additional things and you might not be able to get there.
Yes, I think that's right. And I'm afraid I'm going to drift off quickly, but and I think that shows you though, the sort of interesting sort of mirror imaging maybe is the term for how Edwards and Godinez kind of fit together, because I would say the court in doing the Arguello analysis is looking to whether the defendant really can foresee the consequences of what he's saying he wants to do, which is give up counsel and then represent himself. And I think Judge Hoffman essentially is, that's part of his finding, is that this defendant is not appreciating that problem due to his mental health issues.
So let me ask you the question that I asked your colleague here. It seems to me that although Judge Hoffman did not have the benefit of the Edwards test, that his findings seem to fit reasonably well with the kind of inquiry that we required under Edwards. But I wonder if what we oughtn't do is remand and ask Judge Hoffman to reconsider this question under the Edwards standards. And I would like to get your take on that.
Well, and of course, I listened to the question, thought about it. I don't think that's necessary. And the reason why is because under the Arguello-Godinez analysis, I think his decision is amply supported by the record and by the law that this defendant was unable to waive the right to counsel, and that we can stop that inquiry there. Again, to the extent Edwards may inform our better legal understanding of the components of that, I think that's perfectly appropriate for this court to look at on appeal. You know, obviously if this court felt that the record would not support simply the finding on that narrower Godinez Arguello situation, I would say yes, a remand would seem an appropriate place to let Judge Hoffman conduct that inquiry. But I don't think that it's necessary here. I did want to just mention briefly also the defendant's reasons for foregoing counsel, and that these happened in 2007, and I think they show that he's still suffering a mental disorder that's affecting his decision, and they seem to be driven by his paranoia. And the first one is, he doesn't think that anyone is fighting for him, that if he's going to lose, he's going to lose himself. And he says that his paranoia makes him not trust his counsel. The other thing that he says, which is I would argue is a bit more bizarre, is that, by the way, when he pled guilty, the prosecutor knows that who actually committed those crimes, and he's actually not guilty of those crimes. And again, I would say that indicates, that supports the court's finding that he is actually suffering from some mental problem. And I would say that also fits into his sense of paranoia. I guess I would just sum up by saying that I think the record supports the trial court's analysis. If there aren't any further questions, I would thank the court for its time.
I actually have one more. Right. It has to do with multiple convictions. And a very brief reference officer's test. I guess if you looked at it, you could say, well, maybe it's drugs in the defense. Is that it? That's it evidentiarily for the...
That is my recollection of, yes, what was in the record. And I admit that it's very, very weak and it's very ambiguous. I would just point out, the only thing I would say about that, because, you know, I would thought you were going to ask me if I would concede that was really only one quantum of evidence. And the reason that I don't think that's appropriate is we're under a plain error standard. And I think what we end up with, because it's not raised below, there isn't any chance for anyone to clarify what was the visual evidence or what, you know, what the meaning of that might be. And to say that the plain error should essentially benefit the defendant in the ambiguity, I think, is incorrect.
Well, explain to me how this would work if it had been properly raised. How would this evidentiary ambiguity be sorted out?
Well, I assume that counsel would argue as to what the significance of that statement was, as to what that's what the officer meant, and maybe perhaps there's something else they might have identified.
This wouldn't happen if they did it after trial.
Right.
So this would be.
But it would simply be an opportunity to clarify, and perhaps the evidence is visually there that I can't, you know, see on appeal, that the court could say, yes, I observed what the officer was saying. The officer may have said this, for example, and obviously no one will see this on the record I'm making now. And then he took out some, and then he took some and gave it to me. And this would be a very clear indication that actually he's talking about two pieces of evidence because he's doing something with his hands that shows that. So I think there's that opportunity to clarify what occurred during the trial in a way that I can't do from the cold record here. So, but I again recognize that one, the evidence is very ambiguous, and that the prosecutor relied on the one, that there was one quantum of evidence. So I don't want to claim that I'm going farther than what I have in the record. So, okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I think what the judge did in this case was very paternalistic, and he was trying to protect Mr. Davis from a worse outcome. But the problem with the trial court's actions and the problem with applying Edwards in a case like this is that then you can have a district court reference. I mean, mental illness is a spectrum. There's a whole, I mean, lots of Americans have depression and bipolarism and things that they control. So if a trial court can reference, you know, oh, well, he's depressed, or, you know, he's taking prescription meds, so he must not be competent to make the decision whether to have counsel, you have a whole bunch of people who could potentially lose this important choice that, I mean, the language of Feretta is so strong that the state should not impose a counsel on an unwilling defendant. And so, I mean, I think Edwards needs to be really carefully applied. To the extent that Arguello mentions a heightened standard, a division of this court in Woods said that Arguello was overruled by Godinez. I think, Judge Russell, what you were saying about the two standards is closer to what I understand, is that first the court has to decide whether they're competent, whether they have the capacity to understand, and then do they actually understand? Do they understand the advisements? Do they understand, like, the consequences? Which I think if you read the record and you look at Mr. Davis's responses to what the court was saying, that he did understand. And the fact that he was paranoid and distrustful of counsel could be that he's had bad experiences with them. I mean, there's a lot of bad lawyers out there, and maybe, you know, he wanted to go pro se. Like, he should be allowed to go pro se without the court making a decision as to what's best for him because he has some history of possible mental illness without clear mental diagnosis at the time that he's making these references. So because the record shows that he did understand the proceeding, he had the capacity to make a valid waiver, he did make a valid waiver. And moreover, I would argue that even under an Edwards standard, he had the capacity to conduct his own defense. The district court erred in denying his request and violated his Sixth Amendment right. Accordingly, Mr. Davis requests this court vacate his conviction and sentence in the 2006 case. And with regards to the 2005 case, requests this court vacate his sentences and remand for findings on his motions to withdraw his pleas. Thank you.
Thank you. This case will be deemed submitted.